If we, right, question, yes.
That is think about it.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay.
In our present life, we open 1, 2, and 3.
Or sometime in the past, right. There's already one there waiting to be activated.
I had to start somewhere.
Okay, that's fine. No, we can start there.
Okay, we open 1, 2, and 3. While in that lifetime experiencing 4, 5, 6, and 7 from a past life.
And 11 and 12, of course.
But we activate... Oh, okay. And, oh, yes.
Yeah. yes.
But we activate 8, 9, 10...
They are the ones that activate the one that we've...
In our present life, we go through 8, 9, 10.
Correct.
Which go forward to a future... They become projecting factors for a future life.
Exactly.
Then that future life would have us receive projected factors from the previously immediately perceiving life, which then would get... Okay, which then gives us...
So what we can see is there's overlapping cycles happening.
Right.
I mean, at the moment, we're at the tail end of something that began before and that was activated, actualized at the end of our last life. We're now having 4, 5, 6, 7, and 11, and 12 in this life. So when this life finishes, that cycle that was started, we don't know when, and was activated at the end of last life, comes to a finish. But... In this life, of course, we are starting new cycles, and there are still cycles from past lives that have only got that far. So whether from one from last life, earlier life, or this life, one of those cycles that has been started, we activate at the end of this life, that cycle. And then in the next life, that cycle comes to a finish. The one we activate now at the end of this life.
Then only one more question, which is, you hinted at, well, only one more question on this, I'm sorry. You said some past life, we don't know which one.
Yeah.
So in that case, how can they say you can accomplish it in 3 if there's, does that mean there's other cycles happening in between?
Well, remember, 1, 2, 3 is the beginning of cycles.
Okay.
And there could be many beginnings of cycles in our mind now. One that we've done this life, some we've done in past lives. But only one of those cycles that it's begun, at the end of this life, will get activated. The rest will still stay there. Yeah. So at the end of this life, one of these imprints that we created maybe this life or earlier... will get activated by craving and grasping, and so then that cycle will finish as the next life.
Oh, not intervening lives, but just anything in the past.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So this could happen in this life, last life, 10 lives ago. We don't know.
So I have a two-part question. I think I understood you to say earlier that the key to moving beyond a taste of emptiness to realization of emptiness is shamatha, basically.
Yeah.
That simple.
Well, not just shamatha, but we need shamatha. That's
okay. Okay.
It's not. It's the. It's necessary, but not sufficient.
Okay. The second part of the question is it possible to have a realization of emptiness and squander that, or is it a one-way path?
Depends what you mean by the word realization. A direct realization, according to the text, no. A taste and experience now, absolutely yes. But what I've read in the text, it says when we get to that point of a direct, and we can have what's also called a conceptual realization, and we're going to talk about that in the Vipassana section. But certainly when it comes to direct realization, all the things I've read, it's basically says we're on a one-way ticket. Before that, and it seems like it's not the same point for everyone where we have that one-way path, but before that, maybe yes, maybe no, we're on that one already, but it seems like that's the sort of the crucial point that when we get there, we're really sort of on the way out. Before that, not sure.
Okay.
Okay. Yeah.
I have a question about bardo beings or all of us in that bardo state. We still have all the mental afflictions, like, because we're looking for the conditions that are right for that.
I mean, the bardo, one thing that's sometimes said in the text is that the bardo being, of course, doesn't have a body like this. It is a body of light, and they actually have quite strong powers of mind. And so it's said that the bardo being can see other beings, including human realm. And it's even said that sometimes when people enter into the bardo, they don't realize they're dead. And they see humans, but they don't seem to be able to, they're not communicating with them. And they're going, what's going on here, you know? Mm-hmm. And then it dawns on them they've actually passed away and they're in the bardo.
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes you see that in the text.
But there's no more.
I think
wisdom.
It was a movie like that. Wasn't it Sixth Sense or something with Bruce Willis?
Yeah. So, but there's no more wisdom. Or, like, they're still afflicted all the time.
Yeah. They still have mental afflictions and that. But the bardo being, what I understand is the bardo being doesn't sort of sit there and go, where would I like to go? Oh, I'd like to go there.
Right.
No, we don't have that
choice.
They're
still, like, propelled.
By that, yeah.
Yeah.
They're programmed, more or less.
Okay.
They can't just hang out and go, oh, yeah, I think I'd like to go there, actually, in my future life. It doesn't work like that.
Okay.
Unless we've got to that high level of the path where we are consciously going through the process.
It's a clear light, yeah.
Okay. That diagram yesterday, going from the death process, coarse, subtle, very subtle, by the time the bardo being has a body, is that the subtle mind, subtle body?
Subtle, yeah, subtle mind, subtle
back
body.
Up to,
yeah, back up that level, yes.
So if the beginning half of your life a bunch of horrible things happen to you and you're not doing a bunch of horrible things, are you then...
Burning
up all that bad karma.
Yes.
And then it's kind of excelling you better onto, like, the path.
Yeah. Sure.
Okay, so there's the seed and then all these steps and then it bears fruit with, like, the craving and the grasping, and then that plays itself out in the cycle. So if the craving, the grasping are diminished, does that mean then the seed doesn't?
I mean, here we're talking about craving, grasping, we're going through the death process. So it's not like here now where we can sort of subdue our craving and grasping because we have our coarse mind going, oh, no, don't go there. Here it's really an instinctive automatic process. So it's not like we think, I know what I'm going to do. I'm not going to stop craving and grasping at the time of death and then everything's fine. Doesn't work like that. Unfortunately. Okay. Then just to finish off, there's down the bottom of page 18, there's point 4, which says how their significance is summarized. It says, you should understand well, in particular, how the wheel of existence turns in the context of the 12 factors. Understanding this and becoming familiar with it destroys the unbearable gloom of confusion, the root of all problems. Of course, here, the gloom of confusion, we're talking about ignorance. It is what motivates you toward the path of liberation through exact knowledge of the characteristics of cyclic existence and intense disenchantment with them. It is the best means for achieving, activating the latent propensities by which you will attain the sublime state of a noble being. So again, the noble being here is talking about an Arya being. We're talking about someone who's had a direct realization of emptiness. So again, by either reflecting on the first two noble truths, the truth of suffering, the truth of cause of suffering, and that process, or reflecting on the 12 links, we can come to appreciate how we're stuck in this cycle of samsara, but the fact that we can also break free, and thereby we can develop this aspiration for liberation. The history of this diagram is that I briefly mentioned, I think, very early that one of the teachings that the Buddha gave was these what's called perfection of wisdom teachings, the emptiness teachings. And they were mainly given in an area of called Rajgir, not that far from Bodh Gaya. And Rajgir really literally means the residence of the king. So Rajgir was like the capital of the whole area. And at the time of the Buddha, there was a king there, King Bimbisara,
who was actually one of the Buddha's disciples. And so he appears in quite a number of sutras. And at one point, King Bimbisara received a precious gift from a neighboring king. I think it was King Udayana. And I think it was some sort of jeweled coat or something, something very precious. And King Bimbisara wanted to give something back of equal value, but he didn't really have anything of equal value. So he went to the Buddha and said, "What can I give to this king that was of equal value to what I received?" So it said that the Buddha commissioned the drawing of this diagram. He gave this to King Bimbisara and said, "Give this to the King Udayana. It's much more precious than what you received." And it said that he gave this to King Udayana, who studied it, and on the basis of that became an arhat, achieved liberation. So maybe it can help. I mean, personally, I really like this diagram a lot, and the 12 links in particular. And if you can get a more extensive presentation of them, I can recommend it. And if you want to read more about the 12 links, His Holiness Dalai Lama has a book called The Meaning of Life, which goes through these 12 links in some detail. So that's all I wanted to mention there. And then we can move on to the next topic. And of course, the next topic here is then talking about the actual practices that we need to engage in. Once we've developed this aspiration, mind intent on liberation, what practices do we need to engage in to achieve the goal of nirvana?
Sorry, really quick question, the last thing that you read, the best means for activating the latent propensity.
So these are just our imprints.
Yes, so, but it's always been my question, did we all start out as Buddhas? Like, is
no.
Our Buddha, is that what we say, we have Buddha nature and then all these habits on top of it, but we didn't all start off.
No.
We didn't.
No.
Okay.
Too bad. You can't. See, once you've purified the mind, then there's nothing to cause impurity. Yeah. So it's... The fact that our mind is impure means it's always been impure, but that doesn't mean we can't purify it. So that's the good news. Okay, so the topic here then is on page 19, talking about the nature of the path leading to liberation. And here, of course, it talks about the three trainings. So remember, normally when... this path to liberation, to nirvana, is taught, we have often the teaching of the Noble Eightfold Path. But those eight practices, of course, can be condensed into these three core areas of practice, the three higher trainings. So as we've seen in the context of the small capacity, the foundation is ethics, ethical lifestyle, avoiding harming others, trying to help others as much as we can. So ethics in Sanskrit is Shila. The other two, of course, areas of practice here are concentration and wisdom. And concentration in Sanskrit is samadhi. So samadhi just means concentration in general, and we can develop many levels of samadhi. And I'll talk a little bit more about that shortly. And then, of course, we have the wisdom practice. Which in Sanskrit is prajna. So what I'd like to do briefly now is talk a little bit about the concentration and wisdom practice in the context here of the Four Noble Truths, in the context of striving for the goal of nirvana. And then later, when we go into the Mahayana practices, I want to really talk about both the concentration and wisdom practice in a lot more detail. But just now, to give it a brief introduction, particularly how they relate to this level of the practice striving for the goal of nirvana. So to do that, We can look at a couple of the outlines here where it talks about the certainty of the enumeration of the three trainings. The first, it talks about the stages of disciplining the mind. There it talks about training in ethical discipline makes a distracted mind undistracted, training in concentration balances an unbalanced mind, training in wisdom liberates an unliberated mind. And then if we look at their results, what are the results of these three types of practices? We can see it says the results of ethical discipline that you have not degenerated are the two happy rebirths of the desire realm, that is the human or deity. So here we're looking, of course, at the person of small scope, that if they engage in ethical discipline in terms of abandoning harm and helping others as much as they can, then that is going to create the cause for what's called high status, the continue to have a human or then the higher two existences of the Deva and Asura realm. So these are the results of ethical discipline. Whereas if we look next, it says the results of training the mind, and of course training the mind here means the concentration practice, are the two happy rebirths of the higher form or formless realms. The result of training in wisdom is liberation. So let's see what that really means. And I think I briefly mentioned this already, but maybe just to bring it up again, is when we talk about concentration or samadhi, then there are many levels that we can achieve in the spiritual path. As we're going to see in the context of the Mahayana a little bit later, when we talk about this concentration practice, the level of concentration that is mostly emphasized is this thing called shamatha. Or often translated into English as calm abiding. Although I think in this translation here, I think they're translating it as serenity. In Tibetan, it's shine. So this is the minimum level of concentration we need to develop to enable us to have a stable and clear enough mind to have a direct realization of reality. Anything less than this, the mind is not stable and clear enough to totally penetrate the nature of reality. If it's less than that, at best we can have a strong experience of emptiness, but not a direct realization. So this is what we are aiming for as the basis of our wisdom or vipassana practice. But here, within the context of the medium scope person, particularly in the context of the Four Noble Truths, Theravada traditions, then often when they talk about this samadhi practice, you won't really see so much about shamatha. Rather, they'll talk about achieving what's called the dhyanas.
You say this is when you're reading about concentration practices?
Yeah, within the Theravada tradition. If you talk to someone in the Theravada tradition and they're talking about this sort of practice, often they won't say we're trying to get shamatha or we're doing shamatha practice. They'll say we're trying to develop these dhyanas.
Don't they call shamatha access?
Yeah, that's right. So what we find is that these jhanas are a higher level of concentration and that shamatha is sort of like the entry point into developing them. So sometimes this is called an access or preparation for the first of these four, the four jhanas. Jhana sometimes translated in English is concentration. So sometimes we see the four concentrations. But then, as I briefly mentioned earlier, we can develop even higher levels of samadhi, which are called the four samapattis in Sanskrit. Often this is translated as something like absorptions. These are very high levels of concentration, but here the mind is so absorbed that it's not really a suitable basis for the Vipassana practice. Because in the Vipassana practice, we need to be able to investigate how things exist. And the mind here is too absorbed. There's no longer this mental factor of investigation active. It's completely absorbed. So it's just a completely peaceful state. So as a basis for Vipassana practice, then any of these are a valid basis. Of course, the best is the fourth concentration. Mm-hmm. But we don't have, of course, it takes effort to develop all of these. The minimum is shamatha. So again, generally in the Theravada traditions, which are paralleling this medium capacity person striving for nirvana, they will talk about developing these jhanas. And then in the text here, the result of developing the samadhi, it says to be rebirth in the form and formless realm. So if we develop these four jhanas, particularly if we have attachment to those qualities of bliss and equanimity that are here, then that will create the cause to be reborn in the form realm in the next life. Whereas if we develop these samapattis, because we have attachment to those peaceful states, that's what we want, that will create the cause to be reborn next life in the formless realm. So that's what's said here in the text. Any questions about that? Yeah.
I'm assuming there must be some advantage to achieving the four samapattis, but I haven't heard what is the advantage of that?
Well, of course, at the time of the Buddha, this was considered to be the path to nirvana. That somewhere up here was nirvana. But, of course, Prince Siddhartha hit the top and thought, hang on, where's nirvana? It's just the mental afflictions are just kept on. It's not working. So these are, of course, very absorbed states, very super peaceful states. And if you study this samadhi practice in detail in the Mahayana, they often, particularly a fairly high-level bodhisattva, they talk about this sort of mental gymnastics where they're popping in and out of these various concentrations as a way of improving their mind.
So more of a cul-de-sac on the path, not the direct.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of the path, this is not going to get you any closer to nirvana. I mean, it's a nice, peaceful state, but that's it.
You said the fourth jhana is best, but didn't the Buddha enter the first jhana when he sat under the Bodhi tree?
Yeah. I mean, of course, it depends who you talk to, but yes, that's often the case.
Don't you need that investigative thinking to be able to practice Vipassana?
Yeah, and that investigation, even at a subtle level, exists at the fourth jhana. Mm. The course investigation that's is more refined, but there still is the ability to discriminate, investigate. See, the thing is that why the fourth jhana is considered to be the best is that shamatha and the first three jhanas involve bliss. Nice, but bliss can, you know, this doesn't agitate, but at the fourth jhana, bliss is gone. There's just equanimity. So therefore, it's even more calm. Yeah.
I have a question about the shamatha practice. I had previously received instruction in meditation to focus on the breath, which is what we did for the first several days. And when a thought arises, label it a thought and let it go.
Yeah.
And so my question is what we are starting to do in observing the mind, is that different from the labeling the thought and letting it go?
Yes. I'm going to, of course, talk about this in more detail in the shamatha section, which is, I think, day after tomorrow.
Okay.
But a brief answer now, which may help with the practice anyway, is that with, for example, focusing on the breath, then any thought that arises is a distraction. So we need to, as you said, let it go. And sometimes it's easier to let it go if you give it a label, because by labeling it, you give yourself a bit of distance from it.
Otherwise, you can easily get caught up in it. So in some traditions, they would say, you know, give it a name and then go back to the breath. We don't have to give it a label, but sometimes that helps people to be able to let it go. So if that's the case, then we can use that technique. But again, essentially is to let it go and come back to the breath. So we're letting them go. Whereas in the practice that we just started this morning, where we're actually observing the mind, part of the object is thoughts. So thoughts are not problems. They're not distractions.
Okay.
What's the problem in this practice is grasping the thought and following it. Mm-hmm. So it's grasping the thought that's the problem. Thoughts, not problem. So in this practice, the instruction is not to let go of thoughts, but to let them be. Meaning to watch them as they arise and pass. And if we grasp onto the thought and get carried away, then we are to let go of the grasping to the thought. So again, in this practice, thoughts are not problems. Grasping to the thought is the problem. And so in this practice, we're not specifically trying to make our mind still. Because often people feel that, you know, who don't know much about meditation, they think, oh, the purpose of the meditation is to still the mind. So then often they come into this practice and they try to make their mind still. It does not work. We know from our own experience, if we try to make the mind still, it gets more agitated. So in this practice, we're not trying to make the mind still. We're simply observing the mind. And what you will find, of course, is if you observe the mind and don't get caught up in thoughts, emotions, memories, and so forth, allowing them to rise and pass, we're not feeding them. Which means the habit of that stuff coming up will get weaker and weaker. So naturally, the mind will become more quiet. But if you try and make it quiet, that's like sort of, you know, if you have the analogy is you have a bowl of water with some sediment and you want to make it clear and you sort of, you're doing something in the water to try and push the sediment to the bottom. It's not going to work, is it? It's just going to... All you have to do is you put it down and let it rest, and then it just slowly settles. So same in this practice.
So this isn't to say that it's not a worthwhile endeavor to follow those thoughts, but just that you don't want to be doing that in this space of meditation.
Yeah, so there's the big difference. See, the difference here is that there's a big difference between being hijacked by our thoughts and being the slaves of our thoughts, and using thinking and being the master of our mind. So, of course, we need to think and do things in life. But often we're not in control of that. Often it's we get assaulted by thoughts and then we get carried away by them. So here what we're doing is reducing that dysfunctional habit so that then in daily life, and two things. One, our mind is naturally more quiet and still. And then when we want to think about something, we're in control,
okay.
Not the thoughts.
So in the breath meditation, are we sharpening the vigilance and the second mindfulness? Not necessarily as far as mental factors, which is the focus?
Yeah, I mean, again, we're going to talk about this in detail later, but a brief answer, the two tools, of course, are mindfulness and introspection, or here translated as vigilance. The main of those two is mindfulness. And it said that if we strengthen our mindfulness, our ability to introspect and be vigilant will automatically improve as a byproduct. Okay. So that's all I really wanted to mention on the samadhi practice. So later in the context of the Mahayana, when we look at this samadhi concentration practice, we're going to spend a lot of time talking about this shamatha practice. So that's coming, I think, day after tomorrow. So what I'd like to spend a little bit of time now with, till lunch, is talk about the wisdom practice. Now, often this wisdom, or in Sanskrit, prajna, practice is called, rather than it's called the wisdom or prajna practice, it's often called vipassana.
Or most of you are probably more familiar with the Pali term of vipassana. So both vipassana and vipassana, the VI again means higher or beyond. Passana or passana means to see. So vipassana is to see beyond or higher seeing, often translated into English as special insight or simply insight. So I think that's how it's translated in this Lamrim text as insight. So often this wisdom practice is simply called insight practice. Now, when we talk about vipassana or vipassana practice, then we're talking about cultivating insight. But of course, there are many insights we can develop in the spiritual path. So, in the context here of someone of medium capacity, someone who is striving for the goal of liberation, then generally nowadays, within the Theravada traditions, who that is the goal of the spiritual path is nirvana. When they talk about vipassana practice, then they're talking primarily about three insights that they're trying to develop. And this is on your three vehicles chart, so maybe it's good to have a look at that. It's listed here at the top. So the first insight we are trying to develop in the Vipassana practice at this level is insight into impermanence. Which in Sanskrit is anitya, or in Pali anicca. And those of you, of course, who've done a Goenka Vipassana retreat know very well about this idea of impermanence, because it's the, I think it's the single word that Goenkaji uses the most in the whole 10-day retreat. Anicca, 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 anicca. So I think at that retreat, the main emphasis is to come to realize impermanence. And of course, in that approach, which is based on the Burmese tradition of Buddhism, then the focus is on the body. To focus on the body, the sensations in the body, to come to realize that at the physical level, everything is constantly changing. Of course, we could equally well focus on a mental object or other objects. But in that tradition, specifically, the focus is the sensations in the body, to come to realize that everything's changing moment by moment. So this is the idea of impermanence. And this comes first for a number of reasons. One, of course, is that now we get caught up in our pleasant and unpleasant feelings and sensations with attachment and aversion, and it's a big mess. Whereas if we can come to realize that all the things we experience physically and mentally are changing moment by moment, experientially, this will dramatically reduce our reactive habits, would dramatically reduce our attachment and aversion. So as a starting point, this has a lot of practical benefit. But also, by coming to realize impermanence, that's going to act as a very good basis or support for developing the second insight. Which is to realize dukkha or suffering, to realize the nature of our existence. Because if we can realize impermanence, then we'll realize there's nothing out there that can give us lasting, genuine happiness. And thereby, that's going to help us immensely in terms of coming to realize this unsatisfactory state we find ourselves in of dukkha. And when we, of course, can realize this dukkha, as we saw yesterday and this morning,
if we then, of course, reflect on where is this state of dukkha coming from the mental afflictions and ignorance, and we can see that we can overcome ignorance, then by achieving this realization and then reflecting on the source of that, then that is going to be very helpful in developing this mind intent on liberation or renunciation. So by coming to realize dukkha, that's going to be the basis for really having this aspiration for liberation. And then, of course, once we develop that aspiration for liberation, then we need to strive for that goal of liberation. And how we do that is to overcome ignorance, which is the third insight here, which is the mark of existence of realizing no self. Or in Sanskrit, anatman. And so what I'd like to do now is talk a little bit about what do we mean by self and no self. But before I do that, any questions on anything I've covered so far?
I don't know about in the Theravada tradition in monasteries, but in the Vipassana movement in America, unless it's changed recently, there's no emphasis on attaining shamatha. From your own experience and knowledge, do you think it's really impossible to gain these three realizations without shamatha?
Certainly, from the Mahayana perspective, to actually gain a realization of them, meaning more than just a little taste or temporary aha insight, yes, you need shamatha, because the mind is not stable enough for that to occur. Yes, of course, we can have quite a strong taste of this. And so in some traditions, they talk about this sort of instant enlightenment. But from a Mahayana perspective, what that means is that in an instant, we are having some experience which is sort of similar to what that might be. You know, we're having this sort of little taste of selflessness or emptiness, but it will dissipate.
In the Zen tradition, they talk about kensho, and apparently you can have a lot of these. You know, before you have a full awakening.
Yeah. And also what we find is that in the Tibetan traditions, particularly within the Kagyu Nyingma schools, they also have a little bit this approach to try to get this little taste. But then, of course, if you look at all the practices, then there is very much this integrated into the practices to be able to, because the idea is to have that taste and then to stabilize it. Because unless you stabilize it, it's just going to come and go, and we're not really going to get very far. And we need to stabilize it. This is one of the key components in being able to stabilize that experience.
And this is kind of just to help me integrate that it seems like within the Theravadan Vipassana system that they talk about achieving samadhi as a state, kind of like we were talking about shamatha. Is that
yeah.
Right? Am I putting that together?
Yeah, I mean, samadhi is concentration. So, of course, like I said, at the time of the Buddha, samadhi was seen as the way to liberation. That all you have to do is develop higher and higher levels of samadhi and you'd be liberated. But what the Buddha discovered was that no matter how high a level of samadhi you develop, all that you're really doing is suppressing mental afflictions. So when you're up in these levels, and even if you achieve shamatha, as we're, I think, going to see a little bit in the text in that section, if we achieve shamatha, which is much less than this, outside of meditation, because of that state of mind, a lot of our mental afflictions will be very dormant, though will hardly arise. And so it may seem, in fact, that, oh, we've achieved enlightenment, because my mind is calm and clear and I have no mental afflictions coming up, I'm enlightened. But then, of course, if we don't continue this practice, then the mental afflictions start to reassert themselves, and then people sometimes go, oh, I was enlightened, but I don't seem to be anymore. So, in fact, you find in some of the philosophical
traditions in Buddhism, the ones that are sort of operating at this level, some of them talk about six types of arhats, five of which fall back into samsara. And I think the reason is because they were never really arhats to begin with. Through their samadhi and this no-self practice, they managed to really subdue the mental afflictions quite well. And so it appeared like they'd gone beyond samsara, but then after some time, mental afflictions started coming back. So then they had this list of the six arhats. The first five can fall back into samsara, only the sixth one doesn't. So from a Mahayana perspective, those first five were never arhats to begin with. They were just having a state of mind whereby their samadhi and selflessness practice managed to really subdue the mental afflictions quite well. But eventually they came back. So this is from the Mahayana perspective, how they explain this.
So I think what I'm understanding here, and maybe this is very simple and I should have gotten it on the first thing, but pursuit of a taste of emptiness or pursuit of bliss can be an attachment.
Oh, absolutely. Attachment. Absolutely.
So,
absolutely.
Like I said, I should have gotten that the first day.
Yeah. that's something that I'm going to talk about in the shamatha section of the text, and it actually, and it says also something. I'll just give a brief answer because there's a lot more to be said. But, you know, these samadhis here are extremely blissful. And so it's easy to get attached to it. And so in the shamatha section of the practice, often the texts are littered with warnings to the meditator. Please do not get attached to this experience. And it's very easy. Because there are three qualities that manifest more and more in our shamatha practice. One is clarity. Our mind becomes very clear. Our mind becomes very still and non-conceptual. And we start to experience a lot of bliss. All of those experiences are very pleasurable. So the big danger is that when we start to have those experiences, we go, that's so nice, I want that. And, of course, if we grasp onto them, our whole practice will come to a grinding halt and we're just going to end up with a lot of frustration. So the meditation texts are full of warnings to meditators. The other warning they give is that this state of mind, as I said, is very still and non-conceptual. And so it's very easy to construe this state to believe that they, because the realization of emptiness is a completely no-duality experience. So shamatha experience is very similar. And so if we have these experiences, we can come to the idea, I've just realized emptiness because I had a very non-dualistic experience. And then also the Lam Rim warns about this, and the meditation texts are full of warnings about this. Please do not misinterpret a simple experience, non-conceptual experience, blissful experience as a realization of nature of reality. So these are things we need to be watch out for. That's why a qualified teacher can be helpful. Because often you have, you know, and you see this sometimes in the texts, some disciple has had some blissful experience and they go to the master saying, wow, master, I had this and this and this experience. And the master goes, okay, boring, boring, get on with your practice. Because the student has got so caught up in some blissful experience. And the student and the teacher sometimes is very hard on them. I mean, even some of the great masters, early in their career, you have stories of them where their teacher really scolded them severely for that sort of attitude, because it's blocking us. Okay.
A little historical question. You said at the time of the Buddha there was, these were the practices that were...
Well, in some of the traditions at the time of the Buddha, and that's where Prince Siddhartha started his spiritual path outside the palace, is that it was considered that the developing higher levels of these samadhis was the way to liberation, because these samadhis help us to subdue desire and craving.
Yeah,
and together with that, it was considered that craving or attachment to the body was the problem. So part of that practice as well was to deny the body. So a lot of ascetic practices came together with this.
And do we know how long people were practicing those?
Oh, probably a long time. A long time. I don't know.
Okay.
So I can see how understanding the three marks of existence helps me engage further suffering. Is there any line between that and bodhicitta, like how to extend compassion?
Yeah, I mean that's where I'm going to start this afternoon. This is coming.
Good.
We're sort of moving up to that.
No, that's fine for me. That's useless.
So what I'd like to do now then is just spend a little bit of time talking about what do we mean here about no self or selflessness. So, of course, this word that's used here, self, is a translation of Sanskrit word Atman. One thing we have to be careful with is simply this word self. When we are in the context of discussing the nature of reality, the word self is used as a translation of Atman, and this word self is referring to an overinflated false sense of me. Whereas in other contexts of Buddhist teachings, in English at least, this word self is simply used to distinguish self from others. So there, when we talk about self and others, we're not talking about Atman. We're just talking about me versus others. So we need to keep that in mind. But here we are in the context of Vipassana, wisdom. So there the word self is referring to specifically an overinflated false sense of me. Now, any tradition that says there's something after this life has to posit what goes from life to life and what achieves liberation if they talk about liberation. So at the time of the Buddha, there were many traditions that talked about multiple lives and some sort of liberation from suffering. And a lot of those traditions were saying that the thing that went from life to life and achieved liberation was the self. And a lot of those traditions said that this self had three qualities. That it was unchanging, meaning not changing from one moment to the next. It was unitary, meaning a single thing with no parts. And it was completely independent of everything else. So the Buddha refuted that such a self could exist, because if we actually look at it, it is quite illogical. Because if it had these three qualities, it couldn't really do anything, and it would imply that this self could be completely independent of the body and the mind. And we never have a sense of me apart from on the basis of the body and the mind. So this idea of self would imply that we could have a sense of me somewhere over there. We never have that instinctively. So from a Buddhist perspective, this sense of self or idea of self is only something that we would come to through some false investigation, through some false investigative process, that we intellectually come to the conclusion that if there is something that goes from life to life and achieves liberation, then for that really to exist, it must have those qualities.
So from a Buddhist perspective, we don't instinctively have this false sense of me. But the Buddha refuted it, saying that this intellectual idea of self is completely illogical. But there is another false sense of me we have instinctively that creates a lot of problems. Well, it's something that we don't think about it. It's automatic. We have that sense. It's not like we have to think about it to come. It's instinctive, just means automatically we have that sense of me. So this is what's often referred to as a self being self-sufficient, substantially existent. What this means, self-sufficient, means not really relying upon anything else to exist. And substantially existent means having its own substantial nature. What this really means, and sometimes this idea is called the idea of a master or controller. Is that, and we have this false sense of me naturally, instinctively. And that is that we have this sense that somewhere mixed in here, there's a me. This me that's running the show. This me, and this me that seems to be here, seems to be something a little bit more than just the body and the mind. There seems to be this third thing, this me here, that there's a body and a mind, and in addition to that, there's a me, somewhere here. And that's what it means for to be self-sufficient, substantially existent. And we do instinctively have this false sense of me. You know, we have it in our language. We often say, I have a body, I have a mind, as if there's this third thing, this me, that has a body and has a mind. So this me seems to be more than just the body and the mind. Instinctively, we have this sense. And a lot of our behavior is based on this sense of me. And this is a false sense of me, an overinflated sense of me, that will lead to a lot of attachment, aversion, and suffering. And this is the no self that we need to realize to achieve nirvana. That if we can come to realize there is no such me, there is no self-sufficient, substantially existent me, then we can overcome that ignorance, the mental affliction, suffering, and achieve nirvana. So this is within this level of practice, this is what's said to be the fundamental ignorance that is blocking us from achieving nirvana. And so, of course, if we look at this logically, then, of course, there's a body and there's a mind. But what is here more than the body and the mind? I mean, if you take away the body and the mind, is there this me left over somewhere? We can investigate and we can come to see there is nothing more than the body and the mind here. There's no third thing called a me. And by investigating in this way and coming to realize there is no extra thing, this me here, this self, then that is a realization of selflessness. And we are to hold that experience in meditation and familiarize ourselves with that. And we have, you know, sometimes we have this thought, you know, we look at our body and we go, oh, I don't like this body. I'd like to swap this for a younger, more healthy, more attractive body. You know, sometimes we have these thoughts. And then we look at our mind sometimes and it's a mess. And we think sometimes, oh, I'd like to swap this mind for a more intelligent, more loving, less afflicted mind. But where is this me that could do this swap? Where is that me? Because if we take away this body and we take away the mind, where's the me that's left over? Is there a me left over that could swap out the body and the mind? I don't think so. But that's what we instinctively believe in. That's how we instinctively see ourselves. That there's this somehow this master controller here who's trying to run the show, trying to become the master and controller over our body and our mind. I mean, that's how we think and behave. But this is a false sense of me. And according to this level of practice, this is the root of samsara. We need to overcome this false sense of me. When we later go into the Mahayana and we talk about the Vipassana practice, then at that level of the practice, which is based on what's called the Majjhimika philosophical school in Buddhism, that system of understanding would say that this, of course, is a false sense of me, and if we get rid of it, it'll be big help. But in the Majjhimika, they would say, if you realize this selflessness, that's not enough to achieve nirvana. You need to come to realize this emptiness that we're going to talk about. So that's one little difference, is that the systems of practice that talk about achieving nirvana often talk about that's what we need to realize, no such self to achieve nirvana. Whereas in the system we're going to look at later, the Majjhimika, they would say that's not enough, actually. That it's good, it's going to help a lot, but you need to still realize this emptiness if you really want to achieve either nirvana or enlightenment. So that's a little sort of technical difference.
The meditation that we're doing where we're mindfully observing our mind, couldn't that be that other me?
So one of the reasons, I mean, and I'm going to talk about this in the shamatha section, one of the reasons that in the shamatha practice, I mean, normally people find the breath the easiest, and there are a lot of benefits with the breath because, like I said, it gets us out of our conceptual mind into the body, gets us out of the past and future into the present. So many people find that the breath practice is the one that sort of works best for them in the shamatha practice. But I think the mind practice, which we started to do this morning, has huge benefits. One of them, of course, is in our modern society, many of us are really the slaves of our mind. I mean, we are dominated by our mind. I mean, and by doing this mind practice, we're going to become the masters of our mind. We'll be able to not get caught up in all of our stuff. We'll be able to also quiet the mind and be the masters of our mind. So that's one huge benefit. Another huge benefit is that if we really are looking at the mind, particularly when we look at the related practice of awareness, which I've started to introduce a little bit at the end of some of the meditations, these two practices, which are shamatha practices, because we're looking very closely at the mind itself, they can easily lead into Vipassana practice, to come to realize what's the underlying nature of the mind. So that's another big advantage with using those objects, the mind or resting in awareness, is they're also a very good bridge into the Vipassana practice. So sometimes people doing this sort of shamatha practice can sometimes have this sort of intuitive insight into emptiness. This is possible.
So, could I equate this master controller me with what in other belief systems they might call the soul?
The soul. So again, generally, like ego, I don't like to use the word soul, because I think even in Christianity there are probably multiple ideas about what soul really means. So that would just create mass confusion. But, of course, if you have the idea that soul is something more than the body and the mind, a third entity, then that would equate very closely to this. Or even this, perhaps. You know, if you think that the soul is something that really is not changing, it's a single thing and it's completely independent, then that idea of soul would be very close to this. But also we could have this, I think, idea of soul. But also, that we could have an idea of soul that actually is quite close to the Buddhist understanding of the person that actually exists. That's possible. So you'd have to investigate, what does that person mean by when they use that word soul? What are they referring to? I mean, often, you know, in many of the traditions, we throw these words around, you know, ego, soul, blah, blah, blah. And then if someone asks you, well, what do you mean by soul or ego? They'll go, I'm not sure, actually. I'm not sure. Like in Buddhism, you know, people talk about, you know, getting rid of self-grasping. And then you say, well, what do you mean by self? I heard it in some teachings, so I just sort of, you know, I got to do that. So, of course, that's not going to be very helpful, because to overcome a false sense of me, we have to understand what that false sense of me is and see that it's false. You know, if we don't have a clear picture of what we're believing in, how are we going to investigate whether or not that thing exists? It's not going to be possible, is it? So first we have to get a clear picture of what we believe in, and then using rigorous investigation, come to see, does that thing exist or not? Not just believe it because someone said so. We have to investigate. I mean, this is what Vipassana practice is about, is coming to investigate through direct experience, does this self exist or not? But again, if we don't know what it really looks like, how are we going to know? You know, so we, of course, we can try and empty our mind of all thoughts and stuff, but which is a nice sort of peaceful experience, but this is not a realization of the nature of reality.
So in that example of us observing the thought in the Shamatha practice,
yeah.
Who is that who's observing the thought? And so you have mind, you have body, so what is that?
Yeah. That's we're going to start to look at in the Vipassana practice later in the Lam Room. We're going to spend a whole day on this. To really answer that, I have to bring in a lot of ideas first, and then we'll sort of move there in terms of, well, if there's no self, then who's this me, or who's the witness, who's the observer? Then we can start to entertain this question. The me, the observer, the witness that exists. But first we have to understand a lot of these other concepts to begin to think about that. And that's going to come later.
Will you check me if I'm wrong? So part of what I'm hearing with this is like the mind we're trying to observe right now is kind of similar to like our mind if we were falling down the stairs.
What's the context now? Shamatha or?
Yes. Shamatha.
Shamatha practice.
Again, it's like who's looking at what, right? But I mean, like, our mind when we're falling down the stairs is all over the place. But then there's this other mind that would look at that and go, maybe I won't go down the stairs to care, you know. So that's us. And the other thing that we're looking at initially is not really even us. We just think it is.
Yeah.
Which is the point.
Yeah.
Am I getting that?
Well,
sort of?
There's a couple of things here. One thing we need to be clear about is to not mix practices together. So if we're doing shamatha practice, our goal is to develop a stable, clear, focused mind. In fact, maybe we can... No, I don't have the chart here. Yes, I do. We can bring that in now while we've got it. So you have a chart here with the shamatha on it. This one, if you want to grab that one out... And in this diagram, there are numbers, lots of numbers. There's number 19,
which over the side here is a monkey in a tree, sort of halfway up the diagram. And then if we go over the page, number 19 says, since virtuous thoughts are an interruption at the time of shamatha practice, it is necessary to stop them. At other times, it is not necessary. What that means is if we're doing shamatha practice and then we have a thought of compassion to liberate sentient beings from suffering, or we have a thought, who is this observer? That's an obstacle to our shamatha practice. So in the middle of shamatha practice, that's not the right time to entertain these questions. That's vipassana practice. So when we're doing shamatha practice, we do shamatha practice, and we're not asking, who is this witness or observer? We're simply observing the mind. That's it. Later, or in another practice, when we're doing vipassana practice, then we can sit down and go, well, who is this observer, this witness, and let's look for it. That's vipassana practice. That's a valid vipassana practice. So what we need to do is not mix them together.
But you do bring them together eventually.
Yeah.
Okay.
Of course. Because you need to have a stable, clear mind to do the investigation. So you do the shamatha practice to develop that. Then you use a very stable, clear mind to do your investigation. And then if you do that investigation and you don't find this self, that not finding is a realization of no self. Then when you don't find, you don't keep looking. You stop and you hold that experience with shamatha. That's the object you hold with your shamatha mind, and allow it to penetrate deeper to affect the mind.
But if you didn't have that calm, it'd be very hard to hold on to that.
Yeah, I mean, it's the same. Like, you know, if we've got a difficult problem at work we have to solve and our mind is completely scattered or dull, can we solve the problem? No, probably not. We're probably going to start and then we'll get lost and then we get frustrated and give up. So similarly here, and this is the thing that unfortunately is fairly pervasive in many traditions, Buddhist traditions, is in all the Buddhist traditions, of course, they talk about the same three core areas of practice: ethics, concentration, wisdom. What the wisdom is varies a little bit, but same core practices. So all Buddhist traditions emphasize these three core practices. But then when you look in the traditions, what they're actually doing, often the shamatha concentration practice seems to get left out. You know, we have a lot of these vipassana traditions, vipassana, 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 vipassana. Tibetan tradition, deity yoga, chant mantras and so forth. I mean, all these practices are good.
First time I've heard of this here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But, I mean, if we don't have a stable, clear mind, how are these practices going to be effective? I mean, we can spend a lot of time doing vipassana, a lot of time doing visualizations and deity yoga, but if our mind is completely distracted and dull, I mean, they're not going to be very effective, are they? We're trying to transform the mind. So, you know, maybe it's a good idea to stabilize the mind a little bit with shamatha practice. Of course, if our mind is completely stable and clear already, then okay, but I think for most of us, that's not the case. So, therefore, we need to make sure that we work on that as part of the overall practice. We need to make sure that we're developing stable, clear mind so that all these other practices of loving kindness and vipassana and visualizations and purification and deity yoga are more effective. Otherwise, we put a lot of effort into it. And, you know, I have some friends from years ago who got into Tibetan Buddhism. And, you know, often in Tibetan Buddhism, there's this emphasis very early on to, you know, do the sadhana practice, you know. And there's quite a big practice manual you have to follow, and it takes time. And so, you know, then people dutifully do that, and then they go through this, going blah, 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 tick, finished. And they do that for years and years and years, and nothing happens because they're mechanical and they're not having any focus on what they're doing. They're just ticking it off every day. Okay, there's some little benefit from doing that rather than doing some other non-virtuous activity, but, I mean, we're wasting a precious opportunity here. These practices, I mean, all these practices can be super powerful, but we're limiting ourselves if we don't have a focused mind, you know. I mean, this sadhana practice could be so powerful if we could focus and have a clear mind and have a good basis for it. And the Vipassana practice can be so powerful, the loving kindness compassion practice so powerful if our mind is focused, clear, and not scattered and dull.
Could I just hear you say yes to? I mean, me, it's more been I've had a million powerful breakthroughs in spiritual experiences, and the calamity of life comes along and just wrecks them all.
Sure. Well, is that one thing that would help hold that together? Of course. And what we need to be careful is that we don't go to the other extreme. And that is that sometimes people then, in the end, appreciate the value of shamatha practice and so forth. But then all they do, okay, I have to achieve shamatha. That's all I'm going to do. I'm not going to do anything else, just shamatha every day. In fact, I'm going to go hardcore retreat on it. And then usually after a couple of weeks, they give up. Because, and there's a big danger with doing that. Because, and if we start to get some progress, you know, I said we're going to get a clear mind, a still mind, blissful mind. Very nice experiences. In fact, that's a very nice way of escaping all this mess out here. So then often people turn shamatha practice as a way of escaping from all this mess. So then they, you know, withdraw more and more and more from society, and they become completely isolated and self-absorbed, completely disconnected. And then because they're not developing loving kindness and compassion, often their neurotic mind gets hold of that, and it's a big mess. It's a big mess. So we need the balance. We need to, of course, develop a stable, clear mind, but we need to balance that with particularly loving kindness, compassion practices. If we do this, then that's a wonderful basis for all the other practices. That's where a qualified teacher can help us to find that balance. I think I've said enough. Okay. Any last question? Otherwise, discussion questions.
If the ethics and concentration, they said what results from the wisdom training?
The wisdom was liberation. It said liberation. So, of course, here we're talking about liberation, the goal of nirvana. Later, of course, in our Vipassana section in the Mahayana, we're talking about the goal of enlightenment. Yeah, which is the further goal. Yes, we're going to talk about that in quite some detail. So let's leave it there and then have a few discussion topics. So we saw in these three higher trainings, I mean in the three marks of existence, sorry, that the second insight we're trying to develop here is this dukkha. And we looked at this morning the 12 links and yesterday the First Two Noble Truths. Because these practices are going to help us to develop this mind intent on liberation, which normally is often translated into English as renunciation. And this, of course, then marks the entry point into the path to nirvana. So the question is then, to develop renunciation, do we need to change our lifestyle? To develop renunciation, do we need to change our lifestyle? Second part of the first question, if so, what do we need to change? If so, what do we need to change? And I think in your Lamrim text there's a little bit that talks about this, so you may like to have a look at that as well.
Where is that? Do you know?
It's talked about can't remember now. I remember seeing.
Is it the kind of life through which you halt cyclically?
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, there.
For those who have attained.
Yeah, that's the one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah,
top of page 19, yeah. You can read that and then use that as a basis of your discussions. Then the second question is to simply review your understanding of the Wheel of Life. Simply review your understanding of the Wheel of Life so you can look at the various components just to refresh your understanding. So review the Wheel of Life. And the third question touches on a little bit what we've just been looking at here, this idea of self. And we're saying that there's no such self. So the question is, and this is going to, I guess, stimulate some thinking for our later discussions, is if there is no self, who is the one that goes from life to life and achieves liberation? If there's no self, who is the one that goes from life to life and achieves liberation?